Episode 39 of the Tactical Breakdown Podcast. Today we're talking search and rescue from a law enforcement perspective. Let's get into it.
Welcome to the Tactical Breakdown, a podcast for law enforcement, military, and emergency response professionals.
Stand by.
Where we help you bridge the gap and talk training, tactics, and leadership with the best subject matter experts in the world. Here is your host, Adam Kanakin.
And we're back. All right, this is episode 39 of the podcast. Welcome back. Happy to have you here. I'm really excited today. I got to interview my friend Jamie Sterling, who's a fellow Canadian and former ERT search and rescue coordinator for the Ontario Provincial Police. But before we get into that interview I had with Jamie, I'm really excited to announce that the Tactical Breakdown podcast is partnering with the International Law Enforcement Training Summit, which is taking place in July of 2020. What the ILET Summit is, real simply, is an online, completely virtual training conference for law enforcement professionals. Doesn't matter, you don't have to be exactly in law enforcement or a sworn peace officer. We have content for security, corrections, military, and first responders as well. But really, we've centered around law enforcement. We have over 40 of the top instructors in the world that have trained state, federal, internationally, and over 75 hours of video content. The list goes on and on about how amazing this conference is. So we're going to be releasing that very, very shortly. You can check that out at iletsummit.com. And we're going to get back at you with some more information on that right away. But let's jump into this episode today with Mr. Jamie Sterling and talk about search and rescue. Here we go. All right, Jamie, my man, I just saw you a few days ago, but now we're talking on the phone across the country again. Thanks for taking the time and coming on the show, dude.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Anytime I can talk to somebody about search and rescue, it's a good day, especially when it involves many people such as your fans.
I mean, we're not millions, but there's definitely some diehards that listen to the show. So really excited because I've loved search and rescue. I had the chance to do some SAR training, and it's always super interesting to me because it's one of those groups that doesn't get talked about. It's one of those trades that just doesn't get any light shone on it unless somebody needs you, right? It's like nobody talks about it until somebody goes missing and they're like, oh shit, calling the SAR guys. So this episode's going to be a lot. We're going to get into a lot of the science behind search and rescue. So stuff that's applicable right now for search and rescue, but we're also going to talk about, I mean, kind of broad spectrum about what search and rescue is and why people are doing it. So, why don't we start with your story? What got you into search and rescue in the first place?
Actually, I think it started back in my days of outdoor camping with the Boy Scouts of America and when I joined the OPP. In the late 80s, I was approached by the team leader to join the search and rescue squad. And it sort of started from there. And 28 years later, I retired from the OPP in charge of the province of Ontario. So it was a great transition, right, from a basic operator all the way through training and then into policy maker and responsible for the province.
That's a long time. There's a lot of I'm sure there's been a lot of changes since from day one till now. And so what if you were to pick one thing that you think that's changed the most from when you started doing SAR in the 80s to doing SAR now in 2020? What's the biggest change?
Well, the biggest change for sure is the technology that supports search and rescue missions. Whether you're on the ground or whether you're in the air or in a boat, technology is, in my mind, has certainly been a force multiplier when it comes to the resources that are out there looking for a lost person. And that technology, I mean, it behind that is also the training. Training is ramped up substantially since when I first started in the late 80s.
From my understanding, for most SAR teams now, and even if you're on a volunteer SAR team, whether it's for your city or province, there's pretty extensive training that now happens, even for volunteers. It's not just anymore like a massive call out. People show up and you just start walking through the woods on a grid. It's there's a lot that goes behind it. So can we maybe just go and start right from day one? If somebody is interested in SAR, like what are they looking at as far as training goes before they even get put onto a team?
Well, today you're right. Requirements to be on search and rescue certainly have changed. Back in the day, it used to be people that just wanted to do good for their community and help out. Today in Canada, we have a national standard that's been adopted by all the provinces and territories where they learn how to navigate with a map and compass from A to B at a point on the map. They're able to measure the distance out there in the field by their pace, by their foot. They're also able to navigate in the daytime just as well as in the dark time, in the darkness. So the standards have certainly changed. And with the training, a volunteer could expect to put in 2 to 3 weekends until they get their designation for a ground search course, a national designation. Locally, in a lot of the provinces and territories have their own standards that meet that benchmark established by the national policy. And they have additional needs for their province or territory.
There's a lot that goes into a search and rescue call out. There's a lot of different stages. So maybe let's start with what is the reason why a search and rescue team would be called out in the first place?
Well, it's pretty simple. Because someone's lost and they don't know where they are, and the police don't have that crystal ball to know the well-being of that person. So they call out the SAR resources and search and rescue operations. Now we don't look for the person like we did in the late 80s. We look for the clues, because all those clues will lead us to that person a lot faster. So now the quicker we're called, the quicker we'll find that person. And I know locally in Ontario, most of our searches, the bulk of them, were resolved in under 4 hours. And that's certainly incredible, speaks volumes to a response for 1 million square kilometers and 40% of Canada's population. So the sooner they get there and the more resources they bring to find those clues, the quicker they'll bring that person home alive and in the best possible condition.
Really interesting. When we first spoke, you kind of laid some stats down on me, and I was kind of shocked when you said like the very high majority of lost persons gets resolved in a very, very short period of time, which goes against kind of what I think the general populace thinks is the general timeline for a search and rescue operation.
Yeah. And that just goes to how robust our system is. Where we're able to bring those people home safely, 71% of them under 4 hours in the province of Ontario. So that's quite an accomplishment.
Do you think that some of that has to do with just general knowledge of the people being that get lost? Would you say the majority of it would they be like outdoorsmen, hunters, those types of things? Or is it more kind of exclusive cases of just people kind of wandering out in the wrong direction?
Yeah, well, I mean, but back in the 80s, it certainly was the lost hunters in that. But search and rescue with population percentages has changed to looking for different groups, like folks with dementia, hikers, people that are suffering from depression. We all analyze these cases differently based on their behaviors, and we're able to bring them home a lot faster. And we're learning from that. We're learning from the past. Whereas before, the only source of learning we had was the oldest guy on the team passed on his knowledge. Now we've got history and statistics gathered from around the world to use to help plan our search.
there's a lot that goes into a search and rescue operation when it comes to here's the interesting thing that I want to talk about too, because when we say search and rescue, I know the you know, most people are sitting here listening like search and rescue, okay, someone's lost out in the woods, you got to send the teams out, you know, you get the dogs out, those types of things. But there's also an urban search and rescue, which is a whole nother ball game. So I want to get into that later on. Let's talk though. Let's talk real quick. Let's talk the, you know, the wilderness search and rescue type operations, and let's talk about the science behind it. Like you said, what goes into building out one of these operations? What does the leadership need to know? And then what do the people on the ground need to be doing?
Absolutely. Well, I say every search, in order for it to be successful, is coordinated and systematic. And they will all start at the same place, either the point last seen or the last known position. Resources that will be deployed immediately for sure will be ground searchers. And we're talking small amounts, you know, under teams of 16. Canine units would be brought in. They are able to detect scent from human and also vegetative scent from the ground. So that's a good resource to have in conjunction with your ground searchers. You will be looking for footprints. You'll be looking for broken branches. They'll be looking for signs or hearing signs, smelling signs that the lost person's in the area. Another popular resource that comes, should it be required, is aviation assets, whether it's a helicopter that is able to fly and either use the pilot's ability to see people on the ground, or using FLIR imagery as well, where they're able to, through line of sight, be able to pick off different heat signatures on the ground. Something that, so we're talking that's in the first probably 3 to 4 hours. And another resource that's been very popular has been the, unmanned aerial systems, UAVs, that have come in as well. They offer additional capabilities for aviation. They are also able to pick off movement detection, thermal detection on the ground, and they are able to be deployed rapidly. So those are the resources. Now, what we do with those resources are a lot different than what we did 5 years ago with them. Back 5 years ago, we never hardly used data in search and rescue. But now those ground searchers are equipped with GPS units. We're able to download the data from the aviation assets, where they flew, the altitude they flew, the speed that they flew. So not only are we getting a picture of where they were, but we're also getting that data. And that data helps us prove maybe not where they are, but where they are not. So we're reducing our search area, even though we're not maybe finding that person right off the hop. So that, along with some other data that we bring into it, lost person analytics or behavior, with folks, data from people like Robert Kester out of Virginia, where he studied lost person behavior, and we're able to compile those analytics to help us predict where the person will be based on statistics from prior searches. Gives us a huge advantage.
That's
huge advantage.
Yeah, sorry to cut you off. That's super interesting to me too, is that psychology where you say, okay, let's look at who this person is, like where are they coming from, you know, where did they grow up, where's the area that they're living in, what exposure have they had? Because certain people will have certain behaviors when they get put out in these types of situations, right? There's a lot of psychology behind it, and there's a lot of research that's gone into that, like you said. What are some misconceptions that people have about reactions to being lost in the wilderness? What do you think is one thing that, you know, that people would be surprised to hear about what people do, and then you'd be like, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you do that?
Well, I think a lot of people believe when they're lost out there, they don't believe there's things out there that can hurt them, or you know, Murphy won't be around to get in their way. They think they're safe. They'll be able to walk on a trail, but they don't know some of the stories, you know, whether hypothermia sets in even in the summer or in the fall, what it's like to walk across country in the bush without headlamps or lights or even know where you are. And there's a lot of dangers out there, whether they're creeks, waterways, cliffs. They don't expect that to happen to their loved one or to their person in this situation, where we in the SAR world see that regularly and are aware of those dangers.
I mean, when we talk, obviously we talk wilderness survival. I mean, there's a lot of components that go into it, especially, I mean, you know what? Here's what I'd like to talk about, because this is really interesting from a Canadian perspective. And this is something that you and I had discussed, but Canada has almost all of the, I mean, obviously we don't have rainforests, but other than rainforests, we almost have every other type of climate and area in Canada as a whole, right? We have deserts.
Yeah.
We have boreal forests. We have coastline. We have Arctic tundra. You know, we have prairies and open fields. And there's all these different types of areas that we have that we now have to work and train in. And I know when I was with the forces, each one of those areas has a different type of response, or you have to do things differently in different climates. How much does that play a role in training for search and rescue?
Well, it plays a big role, because we have to train, we have to think of searcher safety is paramount, and it should be the focus of that organization, because we have to have healthy searchers out there and well prepared, because we're not putting them out there in gentle conditions. They're not going out on a bright sunny day. They're going out usually in hazardous environments, whether it's snowstorms, raining, darkness, extreme cold. So we need to prepare our searchers for that, whether it's through wilderness survival training, training that they learn how to survive with the clothes on their back for 3 days, whether it's putting them into breaking through the ice and preparing themselves on what that feels like and what they need to do to get out. All those things go towards highly trained searchers. So when they're out there in the field, and something happens, they'll just say, "Oh, we're prepared for this. It's just like a training day." And away they go. They don't miss a beat. Training is one of the foundations of operational success. So the better trained and the better equipped we have our searchers out there, the better chances there will be for successful results. And that's why formerly when I was with the OPP, we're able to put them out in very adverse conditions, with very few incidents to the actual searchers themselves.
Would I be correct in saying that when a call gets put out for a missing person and there's the assumption a search is going to be conducted, that the police are usually the first person on that scene? Is that right?
Yeah, they should be. And in most provinces and territories, it's the police that are responsible for search in ground search in Canada. Now, obviously, if it's an air search, a downed aircraft, then it's our friends in the Department of Defense. But we work together through partnerships to help each other.
So, yeah, the reason I asked is because, so if we have the officers and the officers are the first to show up, are there any considerations that a general patrol officer needs to make when they are the first on the scene, when it comes to either, you know, picking up on any type of evidence or noticing certain things, possible, directions that the person could have left in? Is there any type of special consideration that an officer needs to show up, even if they're not search and rescue qualified?
Yeah, obviously they'll be looking and hopefully determining a direction of travel. They'll want to gather how old is the person, are they young, are they old? What medical conditions does this person have? Is he alone or is he in a group of three or four? Do they have experience with the outdoors and do they know that area well? What's the weather like now and what was it like when they were lost in the last 6 hours? And what's it going to be like in the next 12 hours? The type of equipment they have, do they know how to use the equipment that they're carrying? And what's the terrain like? Are there any hazards out there that may impede our lost person from getting home safely? So those are all factors that come into play when an officer attends a scene and makes a decision on whether to activate their search resources or not.
who ultimately makes that determination when it says, okay, we actually, you know, obviously this has gone past what, you know, a handful of people can take care of. What does that call out look like? And what is the usual response time?
Well, the call out, I mean, usually in the police world, it goes to a supervisor, and that's fairly quick. You know, it's not something that takes hours. So it'd be within, you know, anywhere from within minutes to, you know, 15 minutes, maybe 30 minutes to deploy those resources. Quite often now those resources, the professional ones are deployed by cell phone. So they're notified very quickly. And even our volunteers across the country are deployed by call out systems as well. So they're deployed quickly. And so by the time that the officer arrives at the call and they make the determination that they need SAR resources, quite often those resources are being deployed within 15 to 30 minutes. And arrival time, obviously, geography will dictate their arrival time. Most times, resources arrive fairly quickly, but within a few hours, you could expect to see the bulk of the resources at the call.
It's really interesting too, and I know this is kind of backtracking earlier what we were saying, but you had mentioned that, you know, search and rescue has been standardized across Canada. Does Canadian search and rescue have a leg up on other countries that we know of? Are we kind of ahead of the game when it comes to the search and rescue game? Or is there one country in your mind right now that kind of is, you know, at the forefront of both technology and capability?
No, I think Canada for sure is ahead of the game, and we're very credible when it comes to search and rescue. We have people from Canada providing training around the world. And I think the standardization for sure of our rules and procedures has helped guide us that way, because we're able to share best practices across our country, and all will benefit from that versus the siloed approach we had prior to this standard. And although we are a big country geographically, response-wise, the search and rescue community is very small. It would be very normal for me to know who my counterparts are in the Department of Defense and call them by first name and see them at regular meetings throughout the year. So we benefit from that for sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm very familiar, but I'm definitely familiar with the, you know, the SAR techs that we have with the Canadian forces. And I mean, a lot of people don't realize that. I mean, you want to talk about highly trained individuals. I mean, you know, the all the special forces guys, the SEAL teams and the Delta guys, if we're talking US, those are the guys that get the, most of the attention. But when we talk, you know, as far as training and capabilities and qualifications go, most of the time, like, you know, we talk about PJs or search and rescue technicians. I mean, these guys have crazy amounts of training. And I would assume that it's kind of goes the same for police departments and organizations. When you have SAR teams that are actually trained officers, there's quite a bit that goes into that training. Can we talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I know within our own agency there with the OPP, they went through 2 weeks of training, which consumed about 110 hours of training day and night, and using compasses, maps, GPS units, SAR situations, SAR role playing. That's just the initial to get them through, and they all have to, of course, pass. Then they'll go on to different specialties like wilderness survival, medic training, SAR manager training, UAV training. So there's many different components that are brought in together for a successful search and rescue team. And I know it's not different, especially with our friends in the Canadian military. They're SAR techs. You know, they're not only they jump from the sky in darkness down to an unknown search area down below. They're medics, they're divers, they're ice climbers, they're rock climbers. They have all sorts of skills. Very humble, very true professionals.
Yeah, definitely. When we talk about the types of training, is there anything that you think should be brought into recruit training when it comes to law enforcement, when we talk about, you know, search and rescue type skills. And this kind of leads now more into the urban search and rescue type events, right? Because, I mean, any officer can be called to something that turns into a search. So do you think that there's any level of training that should be starting to be introduced into recruit level training?
Well, certainly at the recruit level, I know their training is jam full because of legislation, but at the recruit level, they need to understand the urgency of calling and why it's important to call right away, especially in an urban area when somebody is missing. You just picture downtown Toronto and the thousands of people that are walking down the sidewalk at any given moment, contaminating that area and changing it forever. So it's important for them in urban areas to call as quickly as possible because they need to get on it before those clues disappear.
What are the major changes when we go from wilderness searches to urban searches? And obviously, I mean, you can take the obvious examples, like, you know, aerial support is probably going to be less effective, right? Especially in a condensed urban area. Things like tracking prints and things like, or like footprints, not fingerprints, yeah. That'd be stupid. You know, tracking footprints and things like that obviously becomes much, much more difficult. What resources are allocated more for the urban search, and how does that change when you transition from a wilderness search to an urban search environment?
Well, a lot of the resources, believe it or not, are very similar. It's they're used in different applications. Like I look at as much as the, you know, millions of people that are in the GTA area, there's resources there, like the transit systems. You know, our lost person may get on that bus and travel further than they would in a rural area. However, one burst out to all of the TTC drivers and buses and subways, and those drivers are eyes and ears out there should that person get on their vehicle. So it's a help to them as well. They have camera systems that are beneficial where we don't have them in the rural areas. So there's a lot of benefits and some disadvantages as well, I guess, in an urban area.
If you had to say which one is harder, maybe not harder, but, you know, if you get a call out, where do you find it most difficult to conduct searches if maybe there's been a delay in getting the team on the ground?
Well, if there's been a delay, for sure, in an urban area, I mean, minutes count and they count because the clues disappear. And, you know, I'm not saying that the lost person will die faster in an urban area than a rural. Absolutely not. But sometimes the minutes aren't as important in the rural areas because we're able to, those clues are preserved just because of there's not the contamination that they would experience in the urban areas. However, there's hazards, you know, in the urban areas that people don't think, you know, people think that, oh, they're in an urban area, they'll be fine. They could duck into a restaurant or they could duck into a hospital, you know, they'll be fine. But we've had people die from hypothermia in urban areas. We've had lots of that go on that you wouldn't think. So it's just as important to get out there quickly.
Are there any calls that you've experienced in the last 25 years of doing this? Are there any calls that kind of stuck with you where you were like, you know what, this is, you've obviously learned from it, but you wish it had maybe had a different outcome?
Well, for me, I mean, it's the mission is bringing that lost person home as quickly as possible in the best possible condition. So whether we're bringing that person home, I mean, we've brought the bulk of them home alive. There's no doubt about that. When I mean the bulk, probably around 90%. So that's very gratifying. But bringing them home so the family can have closure is certainly an important thing. And you can't shut that search down until you find that person and bring them home. That's gratifying when the family is, they want to bring the person home. Well, one of the hallmark cases for me, though, as a search manager and it was coordinating the Victoria Stafford case. And that's in Woodstock, a young girl that was abducted. And that's where I really saw the role of data in the use of documenting what we did during our search. And I used that data to help present our search efforts to the court in a way that they could understand. And that data was a big plus, a big trump card for the prosecution, that's for sure.
For our friends in the U.S. that may not, or around the world that don't understand that case, can you just give us a quick Coles Notes about what happened in that incident so that they can kind of bring it all together for that?
Yeah, absolutely. It was an abducted eight-year-old girl, abducted from school, and she was walking home that day and she was abducted. And 80 days later, we found Victoria. We had involved approximately 30 to 40 ground searches a day. And at the end, I was able to, after the 80 days, prove that we walked 18,188 kilometers of ground that we covered searching for young Victoria, and highlighted the different resources and what their capabilities were. And it was at that, like I said earlier, it was that time where I thought data was indispensable in that case.
What use, like, if for people listening to this and they're saying, okay, data, you collected data, what types of data did you collect, and how does that help with the search and rescue and in when you're conducting future searches?
Well, the data that we collect, I mean, it can be searcher data off the GPS units. It can be environmental data, that what was the weather at the time. You know, not just the air, the wind, the water temps, when was the moon up, when, you know, sunset, sunrise, sunset, that sort of stuff. And then we're also able to paint a picture as to where we searched, how well we searched, going through that bush with the underbrush at, you know, almost at knee level, and you're looking for a non-responsive person, what would be the percentage of the chance that you would have found that person going through that area? So we calculate the probability of detection, and then we're able to quantify on each time members go through the bush or through an area, what's the percentage would be that they would find that person using that resource. So there is that that's brought into play for data as well. In the old days, it used to be, well, we searched it pretty good. Now we're able to show resource by resource, task by task, how well they searched that area, given the conditions at the time. So now it's much more than just lines on a map. It's how well we're, you know, what's the probability of detection for each one of those lines, and what specialty is brought into that line on the map. You know, is it side scan sonar looking underneath the water? Is it the ground searches along the shoreline? All these variables come into play that are part of our documenting our search effort now. Then we also bring into it not just what the searchers have done, but what would that lost person do as well? And that's basically an overlay. And we look at the percentages of where our lot, given their behavior types, where would they be? What would put them in this spot? So we do a lot of scenario playing.
It's really interesting when I draw in my mind, I keep drawing back to when I got to take a SEER course with the Canadian Forces. And I mean, we do a lot of that is like, okay, here's how to get seen and how to get rescued, right? So remaining in one location, putting up, you know, whether it be some type of ground signage, making, you know, clear open spaces, things that draw attention from the air, right? So that rescuers can see you.
Absolutely.
Things like smoke signals and fires and all these types of things. Where do you think, like, I mean, it's really interesting because, I mean, you say like there's patterns that these lost persons take, and it's, you look at the psychology behind it. Most people think like, well, if I'm lost, I should start moving and get to where I need to go so I can get out of here. But kind of the reverse is true in that to be found the fastest, really, if you stay in the same spot, you're better off. Is that right?
Absolutely. Stay put and try and make yourself as visible as possible. Yeah, because chances are you're not going to hear that helicopter flying over you until it's very close. So you have to have your, like, whether it's a fire going and some boughs or something right beside it ready to throw on. Staying put is certainly the best way. It keeps the energy in your body so you can use it to help you survive through the night or through the next 12 hours. And with hunters, you know, with those people that we were just talking about, only a third of them will self-rescue. So that just tells you stay put is the best way to go.
Yeah, let's you know what, I'm really interested. Can we talk SEER for a bit and or talk, sure, you know, talk survivability? Because I mean, there's going to be a lot of people listening to this that do go out into the wilderness, whether they're hunters or they're just recreationalists or whatever it is. If you end up getting lost, let's talk. Let's share some information from a search and rescue perspective on, if you get lost, here's how not to die. Here's how to get found the fastest. So, I mean, we know that if you get lost, there's a priority to life on things that you need to be taken care of first. So let's talk priorities, and then let's talk how to get found and things that you definitely should not be doing if you get lost. So do you want to just start right from scratch?
Absolutely. Well, I think one of the first things when you get lost, or whether it's an airplane crash or whether, you know, you're a hiker that's put you in an unfortunate situation, the first thing you got to do is first aid and take care of your body and make sure you're all patched up and you're able to go. That's the most important thing. And from there, we move on to fire, because from fire come good things. Heat is important, as well as the psychological effects of what fire does. It makes you feel warm and welcome. So it helps keep your mind off of the incident at hand. Fear is going to be something that's going to come into that person as well. And fear is not a bad thing. It's what you do with the fear that makes a difference. So if you take that challenge on and say, I'm going to make it through the night, then chances are you will. If you take that fear and let it beat you, chances are your survivability will be made a lot more difficult.
You know, it's funny it depends on where you are and where you're listening to this and what time of the year you're in. Cause I mean, when we talk priorities of life, obviously, you know, self-aid comes first, and then, you know, fire, shelter, water, food. I mean, sometimes people have to, please don't take it like you always have to do fire first. I mean, depending on where you are, if you're in the middle of Canada, in the middle of winter, you know, shelter is probably going to come first, and then, or if it's raining or something, like, there's always exceptions to the rule, but essentially fire is going to give you a lot of things in addition to the ability to signal for help if there is going to be you know, rescuers or searchers nearby as well. So from a search and rescue perspective, fire is always going to be important, and keeping that fire at a slow burn or at a position where it can be rekindled easily was actually one of the things that we were taught, was how to keep those embers going so that you always have a fire, and having, you know, the ability to restart that fire very, very quickly so that you have that ability to signal if you need to.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, depending on where you are, material to keep that fire going may be very scarce. So you got to plan on that as well. And also the weather is a big factor, as how big that fire needs to be too.
What things do you see from a rescuer perspective when you find someone, you say, why, you know, is there anything where you're like, why did you do that? But it's something that, like, there's a lot of people doing the same thing, right? Whether it's like, you know, like doffing clothing or doing, you know, there's a million and one things that people could be doing, but is there any one or two things that stand out to you where you're always kind of like questioning people, like, why would you do that?
Well, actually now there's people, the why would you do that are they're climbing hills. They're going away from the population to get better cell signal. So hoping for rescue sooner. I mean,
that's a good point too. Cell phones. Yeah.
Yeah. It's changing their behavior patterns, especially with the younger people for sure. But some of the other incidents, like you mentioned, removal of clothing, you know, paradoxical undressing and all that stuff is very important when it comes into play for hypothermia and for searchers to gauge how badly these people are off, right, when they reach these certain stages. And there's a lot of things that come into play that hopefully the searchers are well versed enough to be able to read that clue and interpret what it actually means. I know when you talked about what are about staying put, I had a person relay a story to me. It was on Lake Winnipeg in the winter. They were coming back from fishing. Their snowmobiles broke down. And so they didn't know their way back to shore. And so they thought it was so bad. They thought they'd make their way. And as they were walking, they saw something up ahead and they thought it was the shoreline, like a dock coming up. And what it actually was, it was their snowmobiles again. They had walked in a complete circle on Lake Winnipeg, on a frozen lake. So there's lots of little stories out there that really reinforce some of these lessons that we're teaching you about stay put, because it's your best chance for rescue.
Are there any tools, kind of like a survival kit that people should have with them, whether they be, I mean, there are, if you, and I mean, depending on your overall budget, I mean, these options can vary significantly, but I mean, we have things like now that people can take, you know, pen flares and all these different types of things with them. Is there anything that you would suggest that, you know, if somebody's listening to this and they're going to go out, it's like, you always want to plan for the worst case scenario. And if you never need it, awesome. But is there any certain materials that people should have on them at all times when they're going out into a wilderness environment?
Well, there's certainly, I mean, I look at things that we used to pack away in our little survival kits for the person. And, you know, the tinfoil blankets that help you with keep your heat in, keep the moisture out, keep the wind out. You know, that combined with a little bit of duct tape will certainly get you a ready-made windbreaker shelter. And I understand they even have little tents now that are made out of that tin foil. So for very low cost, so we're talking a few bucks. So, and takes up very little space on your body. So you got to be looking at things like that, and they can be used for multiple different things. So, you know, whether it's a, you know, bug spray, it works for fire starter, works to keep the bugs off you, like all sorts of different things that you could carry that are multi-use. Hand sanitizer, you know, it can burn as well. Be able to start that with a flint. So there's different low cost things out there that would be beneficial.
Here's what I want to do. What we're going to do, Jamie, next time you and I get together, we're going to actually do a video and we're going to go through like survival kits, people. I think that'd be fun, but let's talk, you and I, what are, if you, your three top three, if you had three things that you get to take with you, three items, and it can be anything under the sun, three items that you take with you in a survival situation.
A flint, a triangular sling, probably a plastic bag.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Are you going to record those? And then I'm going to have to produce results when it comes time for
I'm going to give you that, and we're we're going to go out, and it's a 3-day. That's really interesting. So for me, when I'm sitting there, I mean, fire is obviously one. So for me, I always have a ferro rod. I mean, I think, like you said, you have to have something that's reliable. So that's one for me. A knife. I'm always going to have some type of knife. Ideally something, you know, like that's a fixed blade that I can use for multiple things, whether it be batoning wood or, you know, skinning animals, all those types of things. So a multi-purpose knife for the field. And then for me would be paracord. So If I could get 100, you know, even 100 feet of paracord.
Absolutely. Very strong.
Those would be my three.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. Very, very good choice. And I'm sure I'm probably going to regret the plastic bag, but we'll see what happens there.
I get it. Hey, listen. And for those of you listening, like, why a plastic bag? And obviously, I don't mean to assume, but I'm assuming it's for water, right? To retain water.
Yeah.
Fun fact for those of you listening to this, if you want a plastic bag that you can keep in a survival kit at all times, or something used to keep water, like a bladder, unlubricated condoms work fantastic for anything like that. You can use them to cover wounds. You can use them to carry things, including water. They're just really, you know, they're very handy other than what their intended use is. So just a fun fact for everybody.
And small.
Yes. So, no, that's funny. I'm always interested. Three is tough. Somebody says you get three things, you're like, shit, three. I mean, if I said five, then we'll expand it out. You get two more things to go with you. What are you going to take?
Two more?
Yeah, two more.
I would take, the paracord. I would go with the paracord for sure. That was an oversight. And I would go with some sort of folding saw, like a chainsaw.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Like a wire saw or...
Yep, a wire saw.
I like it. See, for me, I'm sitting here and I'm like, I wonder what I would do. Because for me, like, I like the camp in place option. So I'm like, I would probably take a poncho.
Yeah.
Like kind of like the U.S. Army Ranger style ponchos that can be used as a... can use it to build out a shelter, whether it's a small tent or a lean-to, but you can also wear it if you need as some type of waterproof layer. And then, oh God, I'm kind of set after the four. I don't know what else I'd want. I'm thinking I would probably go with what I already had. I have a knife, I have paracord, I have a poncho, and I have a ferro rod. I don't know. Maybe I'll bring my Walkman or something. iPod.
Well, that's only so good if you can charge it, right?
Right. Yeah. You know what? I know what I would take for my fifth. I'd take a headlamp.
Yeah, a headlamp would be very beneficial because you certainly got to work hard and fast if you don't have a headlamp. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, that, you know what, and that, because people are probably sitting here, they're like, well, why wouldn't you take a compass? You know, it's interesting when you spend enough time outside, and there's a few tricks to gain your bearings without any type of compass. And I'm not saying like, here's how to, we're not talking about magnetizing needles, putting them on leaves in open water and still water and, you know, finding magnetic, we're not talking about that. Simple, you know, astronomy will give you a pretty good bearing on where you are. And, you know, you should never be going out somewhere without doing some type of recce of the area, whether it be a map recce or anything like that. And having an idea of major structure or like, you know, the things like mountains and hills and rivers and you should know a general idea of where they are. And then from that, you should be able to triangulate certain direction. And then all else fails, the sun, you know, rises in the east and sets in the west.
I'm for well sure. Feared. And you know so what I mean? The moon, absolutely. And that's the easiest, you know, easy way to determine rough direction of travel for you. That's for sure.
Yeah. And if the sun's at noon and you don't know which way to go, don't move until it starts going down again. Pretty simple.
Yeah.
And you know what? And two, usually, and this is for people that are farther south than we are up here in Canada, but high noon is usually the hottest part of the day as well. So you should be finding shelter and resting to conserve your energy and hydration. So lots of things. I love talking about this stuff. I love this stuff. You know that.
Yeah. So it's very cool. And, you know, we look at the tactical side, they're the cool kids on the block. Right. But in the end, we certainly do a lot of, neat tricks of the trade as well on the SAR side. And, we get those people to those calls. That's the big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited. I think we can definitely, I see in the future, I see a video series that we're going to put out on search and rescue. I think that'll be super fun. Wilderness survival and types of things like that. So that'll be fun to do. Listen, man, you're doing some stuff on the private side as well. And I know that's why you're out here in Manitoba. Tell us a bit about what you have going on the civvy side since you've left the OPP. What do you have going on with your company when it comes to search and rescue, and where can people find you?
Yeah, well, I've carried on in the search and rescue business. I a company called SAR1, SAR-1. They can find me on the web there or on LinkedIn. I provide search and rescue training to police departments or search organizations or government bodies that want to prepare their community for a search and rescue event should it happen. Doing a lot of work in First Nations communities, helping build resiliency within that community here in Canada. I'm very proud to be part of that. As you know, I'm an honorary 3rd Canadian Ranger, which in Ontario, it's 23 First Nations communities north of Thunder Bay. So I've been in that world for quite some time. And know the challenges that they face. So I'm always wanting to help out those remote communities and help community members help the community. That's what it's all about at the end of the day. So I've got that going on. I also have UAV Ground School, where we're able to, in Canada anyway, bring law enforcement agencies up to Government Transport Canada or regulations for UAV Ground School. So it's all pretty exciting stuff, new stuff where I'm coming out with some new technology that I hope will revolutionize the world of SAR. We'll talk about that at a later time, but where I'm using partners like the University of Waterloo that are helping with the research and using data and analytics, as well as Ryerson University in Toronto. That's helping UAVs find people with dementia by the creation of an algorithm. So I'm very excited about that new stuff that's coming out. And hopefully we have more for you in the future.
Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, we got a chance to talk about it a bit offline there. And I think it's fantastic stuff that you're working on. And I'm really excited for if and when it does get rolled out. Totally going to be a game changer for you. And so for those of you listening to this, if you didn't catch that, if you go to sar1.ca, so that's sar-1.ca, that's where you can find Jamie. And as well, you can go on right on to the show notes page for this episode, click right on into the breakdown.ca episode page, and everything will be there for you. All the websites, links, and everything there. So listen, Jamie, man, I'm so, I appreciate you coming on the show, and I'm so glad that we had the chance to do this, dude. We're going to have to do it again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that conversation I had with Jamie. If you're finding this information actionable and useful, please consider subscribing to the podcast if you haven't already. And make sure to add in your calendars the last week of July 2020, the International Law Enforcement Training Summit. Again, you can check that out at ILETSummit.com. Or to get more information on that, you can email me directly, adam@ILETSummit.com. Thanks so much for being here, and we'll catch you next time on the Tactical Breakdown. Stay safe.